Darling, you sent me. I know you sent me. Darling, you sent me. Honest you do, honest you do, honest you do.
60 years ago, that was the number one song, sat atop the Billboard charts for 3 weeks for the great Sam Cooke. And was quite a departure from the work he had been doing before that, but set him off on a remarkable career of success on the pop, the R&B charts as well. To talk about it, we're joined on the phone by great friend of the show, Colin Fleming. You know his work from every publication worth reading out there, and of course, NPR's Weekend Edition as well. Colin, great to have you back with us.
Hey, thanks, Rich.
For anybody who doesn't know, they think of You Send Me as the beginning of Sam Cooke's career, but that was far from the case. He had had great success with a group called the Soul Stirrers starting back in the early 50s.
That he had. In fact, when he recorded his first single, there's one that predates You Send Me, called Lovable from 1956, he didn't want to be billed as Sam Cooke. He went with Dale Cooke in fear of alienating that gospel audience. But yeah, when he was with the Soul Stirrers, there's a wonderful like 20-minute live document from the Shrine Auditorium in 1955 that is just one of the best segments, live segments, in all of rock and soul history. He was just this dynamo on the stage. In fact, you would have sort of the teeny bopper element would scream, a la, as they would later with the Beatles, and rush to the front of the stage to get a better look at this amazing vocalist.
And there were concerns from his record company, too, about him breaking away and doing secular music.
Yes, there was. In fact, one of the themes of Sam Cooke's entire career, I think, it's a sort of identity crisis that is being worked out over the duration of his discography. That when he first came on the scene as a solo artist, you wouldn't actually hear in the mainstream charts a lot of black-sounding musicians, like someone like Chuck Berry, people would say sounded kind of white. Fats Domino was sort of cloaked in a novelty aspect. That's kind of how his R&B was gussied up, almost like he was this rhythm and blues Fats Waller type of person. And so to make Cooke thought to be more palatable for like some white girl's sleepover type of thing, there was lots of strings and what we might think of as kind of schmaltziness with his vocals sort of having to contend with that. But when you think about a song like You Send Me, which came out 60 years ago, basically right around now, it's this spiritual song in a sense, like very non-secular, but it's a ballad, which is what spirituals usually weren't. So it's occupying this weird in-between space. And if you think about the phrase, like, you send me, like send you kind of where? It's just this wonderfully evocative phrase that codifies the feeling and you're being sent to this romance-tinged ether almost. And I think that's how Cooke got into the listening consciousness, was through that kind of approach.
Now you mentioned Lovable, his first release as a solo artist. Let's listen to a little taste of that.
My girl, she's lovable, she's lovable, my girl.
Wait, but even that, Colin, that just sounds so different than so much of what was out in 1956.
It's very melismatic, the way he stretches out the vocals, the vowels. It's like, I almost think of it this way, too. When he finishes a line, like if you listen to the way most people talk and how almost everyone sings, when they come to the end of like their statement, there's like a finish line there. The syllables kind of hang over the edge a little bit. There's sibilance. But if you listen to someone like Orson Welles on the radio or Alistair Sim in the 1951 version of A Christmas Carol, when they hit the end of the line, it's definitive. They stop right there. And Sam Cooke, he sings that way, kind of like the opposite of Otis Redding. But like when he's doing You Send Me and he repeats those lines, honest you do, he builds up this rhythm in the voice, really. That is kind of where the R&B in his work emanates from is that singing style, coupled with those stretched out melismas.
His singing is so good, so incredible, and so memorable that it overshadowed the fact that most of his big hits were songs that he wrote, and he was a terrific songwriter.
He was an amazing writer. In fact, someone mentioned to me once Sam Cooke in connection with Bob Dylan, and they said, well, you would never think of the two in tandem. And it's like, well, you kind of would. He would sort of blend in a way Billie Holiday-isms, like he covered an album of Billie Holiday songs, with a sort of like folk approach to his writing. Like if you listen to the live version from 66 of Dylan's One Too Many Mornings, where there's so much power in the line that he'll just sing a line and leave it hanging out there, that's a lot of how Sam Cooke operated too as a writer. It was very similar to that. And All of You Send Me, he wrote Bring It All Back Home to Me. And one thing I think that's interesting, too, is on an album like his 1963 Harlem Square Club date from Miami, you can hear how the way he would perform on stage would inform the way he wrote. There's a cover on that album of You Send Me where it's all this kind of rocking rhythm. It's very powerful as a bass, but it goes from like one chord to another, rocking between the two of them, like John Coltrane would kind of do. And you see that kind of grow up into what he would do with the opening vocal passages of a single like A Change Is Gonna Come. So he was always in flux that way as a writer throughout his short career.
And was also not afraid to honor others and share his interpretation of their work, as evidenced by his album of Billie Holiday covers.
Yes, and I think Cooke learned a lot from Billie Holiday in the sense that neither was overtly political in a way, even though Billie Holiday had Strange Fruit and Cooke would later have A Change Is Gonna Come. But I think they embraced change in terms of the level of the individual. That's what you see in a lot of Billie Holiday's music. You see it in a lot of Sam Cooke's. And I think that's how they both became sort of anthem friendly for the civil rights movement, because you can't have widespread social change unless things first start with the individual. And I believe that both Holiday and Cooke dialed in on that notion. And he's under those strings again on that particular album of covers. But so is Billie Holiday sometimes too. And yet Cooke is always building that rhythm in the voice. So you never lose the spiritual aspect, the rhythm and blues aspect. It's always there waiting to come out.
Well, we're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown about the great Sam Cooke and the best, for my money, the best coalescence of his songwriting and vocal talents came with a song that became an anthem of the civil rights movement after his death. A Change Is Gonna Come, certainly one of the most crucial songs in that movement, and I think in modern American music. Did Sam Cooke have an idea how important this song might become?
I would say that he had an idea how important it would become in terms of his own development. To me, he was always building towards a song like that. We go back to the gospel recordings of 1955. We see it in those melismas of You Send Me, where if you listen to the demo, it's like folk music crossed with rhythm and blues, always working to find that ideal melange. You hear it in the Harlem Square Club album, where he's on stage with a black band, and oftentimes he tour with the white band, and he's working out almost like he's the conductor through his voice, the different musical cues, shaping the songs. He's writing as he sings, in a sense. And I think all of that coalesces into this aha type of compositional moment where he writes a song that, think about how stately A Change Is Gonna Come is. The level of confidence you have to open it like he does vocally, and then it like doesn't hurry into the next line, the next verse. He just leaves every line out there. That is so virtuosic, like nothing you could ever follow. So, yes, I'm sure he must have known that things have crystallized with the writing of that number.
Now, you say you believe that the demo version is one of the great demos in rock and soul history. Why is that?
The You Send Me version, I would say, is it starts very plaintively. It's quite interesting. Cooke says, he just introduces it. He says, this is you, send me. Like, someone's going to forget, right? And it's that stripped-down sound. So it's kind of like this elemental blues, in a way. It doesn't have really the production yet, and it's quite intimate. And it's just one of those demos that if the final recording didn't exist, you can do this sometimes with, like, a Pete Townsend demo, it would suffice as, like, this landmark recording. He has it all worked out ahead of time, but you see that strange blend of just folk music, spiritual music, and like R&B, and they're not things that usually go together. I mean, think about something like the Beatles' Rubber Soul album. Blends the same things too, but like it has that overlaid Beatles sound. This is the unfettered, unadorned version of that, and it's striking.
Of course, Cook died young and died that a very bizarre and still in many ways mysterious, a disputed death. What did that do? And did it do any harm to his lasting legacy?
I think it did harm to his lasting legacy in terms of that this was a guy who was just getting going. Certain people, they reach whatever level they're going to reach and the development kind of halts. But someone like Sam Cooke or Buddy Holly, who are both compositional and sonic innovators, were just going to keep doing. He was going to do the Dylan thing. So I think that definitely hurt him. The death itself is shrouded in enough mystery. I mean, it makes something like Brian Jones's death with the Rolling Stones look like a basic young adult like mystery novel. Sam Cooke, whatever happened with him, whether he was attacking someone, whether it was an attempted rape, there was that, there was Etta James saw his body afterwards and thought he had been, like, horrifically murdered. And even, like, people thought it had something to do with Alan Klein, who would later manage the Beatles.
Right.
It's such a shady story that's one of those things that no matter how much you read about it, you just think, well, we're never going to know. So I think it, like, became a point of notoriety, but it's also so nebulous as to what actually happened that I don't think it disparages his music or anything like that.
Well, for anyone who's not aware of the full body of work that Sam Cooke did through his long recording career, go check it out. There's so much great music out there to be discovered and beyond the hits as well. Colin Fleming, is always great talking with you. You're going to be back with us next Wednesday to talk about some of the greatest hockey ever played in the world 30 years ago.
The greatest. Yeah, I've only seen these games like 200 times, so I'm ready to make my case.
Yeah, next Wednesday we'll talk with Colin about the 87 Canada Cup. And, boy, you shared the video with me, and I went back and watched that. And it's remarkable, almost like a different game.
Yeah, it really is. It's the pace. And if you notice in the video, one of the announcers says to the other announcer, "Do you believe this pace?" Even like they're incredulous. So, yeah, it's a lot of fun.
Well, we look forward to it. Colin, thanks as always for being with us. Have a great weekend, and we'll talk with you next week.
All right. Thanks, Rich.